You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Today I want to introduce you to my friend, author Alyssa Warren. And it's weird to call her my friend because we've never met, and before today we've never even spoken. But over the years, Alyssa Warren has, in her role as literary publicist, arranged for dozens of fantastic authors and their books to join me here on the show. And Alyssa Warren is also an educator who teaches courses on book publishing, book publicity, and book editing at Emerson College in Boston. And she is the author of a very useful handbook called The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity, a comprehensive resource from building the buzz to pitching to the press, and an incredibly moving memoir, The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. Alyssa Warren, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks. I think of you as a friend too, Gary. Nice to talk with you finally.
Finally. Well, before we talk about your career in publishing, I want to ask about The Good Luck Cat, which I just love the book so much. And it's not really a cat book. You know, a few years ago, there was a British humorist named Alan Corrin, and he did some research, and he found that cats, golf, and Hitler were the best-selling literary topics. So he wrote a book called Golfing for Cats, and it had a big swastika on the jacket.
But, I mean, that's brilliant.
Yeah, it really was. Now, your book does have a cat in it, but it's not. It's really a very moving memoir. Can you talk a little bit about The Good Luck Cat?
Sure, thank you. It does have a cat in it. It does have a cat on the cover. It also has my hands holding the cat on the cover and my mom's hands holding the cat on the cover, and it's about our cat, Ting Pei, who we got from my father when he retired because my mother was still working and I had just started my career and wasn't home very often. And we wanted a companion for him, and she was that and then some. She became the soul of our family and his shadow, not just because she was gray, but because everywhere he went, she went. And eventually, my father got ill and had heart disease, and then in the end had a heart attack that took his life. And a year later, we found ourselves looking at a heart screen, you know, monitor screen again, seeing problems, and were told that Ting, who was hooked up to the other end of the heart monitor, had a heart condition as well. The cat had a problem with her heart. We weren't ready to lose another member of our family. We're a really tiny family. It was just me, Mom, Dad, and Ting. I don't have any siblings. So we did everything we could to save her. We took her to Angel Animal Medical Center in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, and I'm putting a plug in for them because they saved the cat I loved so much. They told us she needed to have a human pacemaker in order to survive because she needed a pacemaker and they don't make them for cats. So $14,000 later, we had a human pacemaker. I know. And she was 14 years old at the time. So it was, you know, it was quite the investment for whatever time we would have left with her. But you know what? We had a lot of time left with her, it turned out. It was a successful surgery. And I won't tell any more of what's in the book. But gosh, it very much is a story of family and pets and the way that they both complicate and enrich our lives.
So how long did Ting live?
She lived until 21. We got a lot of extra years with her.
Yeah, you know, I have a cat that's 19, and I haven't done anything to take care of her. I mean, I do feed her occasionally, put some water out.
But
I don't, you know, like you tasted the food. No, you didn't actually taste the food, but you got every kind of possible cat food for your cat, and of course you spent.
We tried it all, because right after the surgery, it depressed her appetite a lot, and it was tricky to get her to eat again, yes.
And $14,000. You know, I think when people get a kitten, they don't realize that they're making a lifetime commitment.
Hopefully they are. Ideally they are. They should be. They shouldn't do it otherwise. I've since come to volunteer at a cat shelter here in the Boston area, and when I see the kind of people that come and adopt cats, it puts what I did for Ting to shame, in all honesty. Some of them adopt cats that have seizure disorders or diabetes where they need multiple insulin shots a day and their owners can't go on vacation because who would be there to give the shot to the cat? They adopt cats who are missing legs or missing ears or missing tails or even cats that are just painfully shy, and a painfully shy cat can be an aggressive cat because it's fearful. So there are just some amazing human beings out there. And one of the lovely things that's come from the book is connecting with a cat shelter here in Boston. They had me go and do a reading at their cat shelter. It smelled a little bit like cat pee. It wasn't very glamorous, but it was a great event. It really was.
And were you reading to cats or no? No, I guess not.
No, there weren't. Well, actually, I guess I was. They were in the room at the time, but there were humans who were listening.
it's an amazing story, and I really love this book, and I'm going to buy it for all my friends. I had a vet. His name was Dr. Shoemate, and I had a cat that had got hit by a car and broke her femur. And he said,
wow.
He said, well, we could do a surgery. This was 30-some years ago, maybe 40 years ago, now that I think about it. And he said, you know, we could put a pin in the, you know, and repair the broken femur. And it would cost, and he told me how much it would cost, which was, you know, a lot. And he said, or you could, you know, let her get better by herself, and she'd probably get like 75% use. And I said, really? He goes, yeah, with cats, you got to operate faster. They get better by themselves.
The bones heal quickly. They're so tiny, I guess. Yeah.
So I said, well, I'm going to opt for that. And she was fine.
She did okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Good.
So I saved myself $14,000.
And a lot of time helping the cat recuperate, you know, that too.
What about your own health? Your own health issues are also featured in this book.
They are. So after we got Ting through her health problem, I woke up one morning and my left side was numb. And I thought maybe I had pinched a nerve, or I don't even know what I thought it was. But I didn't think it was a huge deal. But then, you know, the week went on and it seemed to be getting worse and definitely wasn't getting better. And so I was such a healthy young thing at the time, I thought, I'll just go to the little walk-in clinic, the minute clinic kind of equivalent, and see what's going on. And, of course, they immediately said, you should go to the emergency room, which I did, where they said, you should go see a neurologist tomorrow. We have a early morning appointment for you. And so off I trotted to the neurologist. And I, of course, spent the night, like you always do in those kinds of situations, Googling WebMD and Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic and all of the great hospitals here in Boston to see what my symptoms mimicked and mirrored. And I had it narrowed down to a few things, and none of them sounded particularly great. But I had a great neurologist that morning who got me an MRI immediately. And I said to him before he sent me down for the MRI, I think I know what this is. And I told him what I thought it was. And he didn't say anything, but he said, well, we'll find out. We'll get to the bottom of this. And so I went down for the MRI, came back, and he said, well, you nailed it. You have MS. So I have multiple sclerosis, and that was about 6 years ago that I was diagnosed with it. I'm doing really well. I still carry on the same life that I was carrying on when I was first diagnosed. Still working full-time, still able to walk on my own without even a cane. I mean, I consider myself super, super lucky. I'm now under the care of amazing doctors at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston, and I feel so lucky to be in a city that has great, great, great medical facilities where you can get top-notch care. And as I'm saying all of this, I'm hoping that I'm not saying all of it too rapidly. I went and had an infusion of steroids just this morning, actually just a couple of hours ago, because an MRI that I had last Saturday did show a new lesion on my brain, which is par for the course when you have MS, but not something that the doctors want to see and not something that I want to hear or see. I've seen the MRI. I've seen the little enhancement, as they say. But, you know, it's going to be under control again, and I'm getting along pretty well. And I have to say, in all honesty, you know, I don't want to have MS. Nobody ever wants to have multiple sclerosis or any disease like that, any autoimmune, anything. But it has made me just have a bigger heart for other people. I mean, now when I see a stranger walking with a cane or, you know, shuffling their feet and going a little slow, instead of getting annoyed and thinking to myself, how can I get around them, I think to myself, like, gee, maybe I should walk into the elevator ahead of them so that I can hold it open for them so that they don't feel rushed trying to get into it before the door is closed. Like, it really has made me a more decent human being, and it stinks that it takes something like a demyelinating brain disease to make me a better person, but it has done that. I'm not saying I would vote to have it again, but it's become part of who I am now, and it's okay. You know what I mean?
Well, not exactly, because it hasn't happened to me, and I hate people, and I especially hate them when they're walking in front of me so slow. But, but do you think that it's has the course of your life been altered?
I think in some ways, in positive ways, and that it's made me more grateful for all of the years that I had before I was sick, and grateful that I'm not sicker now, that the disease seems to be progressing pretty slowly for me. I did get laid off back in January from a publishing job that I had had, you know, in-house working at a company for 20 years. And, you know, I miss going to work every day. I started my own company, my own freelance book publicity firm. But now my commute consists of shuffling from the bedroom through the kitchen to the living room, also known, at least for tax purposes, as my office. And, you know, it's a little bit of a lonelier life in some way, that I don't have colleagues on a daily basis that I can see and sort of do that awesome water cooler chit-chat. I miss that. But I think that having MS and having a job that I can do from home for days when maybe I'm not feeling my best or not getting around as well as other days, it is probably actually a really good thing. So I haven't really tried to find another job at a publishing company, because working from home, especially during the winter in Boston with snow and ice and all that other, like, tougher to get around stuff, it's a good thing to be able to work from home, and I feel fortunate that I have a career that I can do from home. So in that way, I think it has changed my life a bit, but I'm dealing with it. I'm coping with it. I still like the work I get to do every day. I still am excited every morning when I wake up and think, oh, today I get to, you know, see that Wall Street Journal review of that book that I tried so hard to get them to review, or, ooh, tonight's the night my author is going to be speaking at Harvard Bookstore or Carmichael's Books in Louisville, or, you know, whatever amazing independent bookstore I have an author speaking at that day. So I still get a kick out of what I do, and I'm still able to do it. And now I can do it in my pajamas, sitting on my couch, which is pretty darn nice, especially on days when I'm not feeling fantastic, which aren't that many, but you just kind of never know when it's going to be that kind of a day with MS. So it's nice that I don't have to plan around the disease. I can kind of just roll with it, which is good.
Well, we have that in common because I'm on the radio. So,
are you in a studio now, Gary?
Yeah, I'm not wearing any pants, but that's okay. All right. So, let me ask you: do you think that, I mean, were you laid off from the publishing company you were working from because the internet has killed everything, including the book business?
The internet has not killed the book business. The book business is alive and kicking. I swear it. I was laid off because a company that I had worked for was purchased by a larger company. And they did what, you know, those larger companies usually do. They didn't rock the boat by having a lot of layoffs for the first couple of years. They kind of got their bearings, saw where there were redundancies. And they also, I was working for the Boston office. They really wanted to have things centralized from the New York office, which I get, which I totally get. And it wasn't just me. I mean, it was a number of other senior level people. I was a VP at the time. I had two colleagues who were VPs who got laid off at the same time, an executive editor. Like, that just happens in the book business, unfortunately. You know, imprints get folded into other imprints. That's big publishing these days, and it was one of the big five publishing houses that I was working at. In publishing, there are five major companies that everybody refers to as the big five, and I was at one of those. And that happens at companies of that size. They are corporations, you know, make no mistake. And also at the time, our publisher, my boss, was retiring, and that was a good opportunity for them to look at, you know, how many editors they had, how many marketing people they had, how many jacket designers, and, oh, how many publicity people they had, and that was me. It came as a surprise, but not a surprise. you know. And I was lucky. One of the lovely things about publishing is it's a business of relationships, and I had friends at other presses get a hold of me as soon as they heard about it and say, hey, do you need some freelance work? We'd be happy to throw some your way. And that enabled me to start my own freelance book PR firm. So it all worked out in the end. It really did.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO. And we're talking this week with author Lissa Warren. She's written a book about book publicity called The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity, and also a marvelous memoir called The Good Luck Cat. Before the break, Lissa Warren, we were talking about the impact of the internet on books and bookselling, and you mentioned independent bookstores, and there are far fewer of them than there used to be.
There are fewer, but with the demise of Borders, rest in peace, Borders, it was, you know, for a chain, it was an awesome chain, that enabled more independent bookstores to survive, and I think the whole shop local movement has done a lot for independent bookstores. Many of them are still alive and kicking and doing great. There are a couple here in Boston right now, Paper Cuts in Jamaica Plain and Brookline Booksmiths in Brookline, Massachusetts, that are actually expanding, like they're taking over, you know, the space of the next shop or the shop down the street to grow their children's section, or one of them is going to put in a restaurant and cafe that will hopefully draw even more people to the store. Like, they're not dying on the vine. They're growing. They're adding staff. They're adding shelving. So many of them are doing just fine, and some of them are going like guns a-blazing. I mean, you look at stores like Powell's in Portland, Oregon, and you look at Elliott Bay in Seattle, Roman's in Pasadena. There are just so many incredible independent bookstores out there, and I want to encourage your listeners to shop indie. Go to independent bookstores, not just because we don't, any of us, I don't think, want to imagine a world without independent bookstores, but also because the care that you get there is amazing. They know their clientele. They know their community because they're members of their community themselves. And, you know, independent bookstore buyers order books with specific customers in mind. They say, oh, I know so-and-so loves, you know, thrillers with female protagonists, and here's a great one that just came out that everybody's talking about. I'm going to get a copy because I know they're going to buy it. And then when that customer walks in the store, they say, oh, you know, Steve, or oh, Jane, I just got this book for you. I think you're going to like it. That's the kind of store that I want to shop at. That's the kind of bookstore that's my dream. I mean, you throw in like a bookstore cat and you got me as a loyal customer forever. But even without the bookstore cat, like, who doesn't want to go to a place like that to do their shopping for books? And it doesn't feel like shopping when you go. It feels like a friend recommending a book to a friend who over time they really get to know. I love that. So they're still doing okay, but yes, they do need our support. So shop at your local independent bookstore. That's my plug.
There used to be a shop here in Santa Cruz that had a store turkey. I'm not kidding.
Are you serious? Yeah, wait, aren't they mean? I thought they were kind of aggressive.
This was a
bird.
Very friendly one. And it sat in a little basket, so when you walked in, it was sitting there.
Of course it did.
I mean, and when you whistled to it, it would gobble.
Wow. I got to get me one of those. That's neat.
And the turkey had a pacemaker. That was the most amazing.
Ah, how about that? They should write a book. That's brilliant.
So let me ask you, when I get a book from you in the mail, I pay attention because you sent it to me, and I don't want to ever have a guest on my show that I haven't read their book. So I have to trust, and I do when I see Lissa Warren. I know it's worth paying attention to. But so how do you decide what do you ever have you ever had a book that you were pushing that you didn't feel passionate about, or how do you get?
Oh God, yes. I mean, you know, you have to give every book attention. You can't choose your darlings in that way. You can't pick your darlings. You have to be an advocate for it. And there are books that I'm prouder than others to publicize. I will absolutely admit that. I got to work on Tim O'Brien's first book in 18 years just a few months ago. he was my freshman, like, commencement speaker as an undergrad a bunch of years ago. To come full circle like that and get to represent a work as well-crafted as his book, which I'm going to also plug, Dad's Maybe Book, that was such an honor. I can't even begin to tell you. But there have been others where I've had to kind of hold my nose a little bit and think to myself, okay, this isn't the book we thought we were getting when we acquired it. Because for nonfiction, which is what I mostly publicize, you acquire a book on proposal, on sort of an outline, as it were. You don't know for sure that the author is going to be able to pull it off. Sometimes they're able to pull it off beautifully, even better than you thought they'd be able to do. Other times they fall short, and even the best editor cannot get that book where it needs to go. So I'm not super proud of all of them, but one thing I will say about being a freelance book publicist now, my own company instead of working in-house at a publishing company, I can be much more selective now. If I don't think a book is a great book, I don't have to take it on to represent it, to publicize it. So I now have that freedom 25 years into my career to be more selective, and it is very freeing and very nice.
So how did you get into this field?
I stumbled into it, like I guess most people kind of stumble into their careers. I was an English education major undergraduate. I double minored in American literature and creative writing, and then I decided I wanted to move to Boston after I graduated from undergrad to be where my parents were. And there were some book publishing houses in Boston, but not a ton. I knew by then that I didn't want to teach. I really enjoyed teaching at the high school level. I liked the kids and I liked the material, but it was really hard to get the kids interested in the material. I much prefer teaching at the college level, it turns out. So I knew that teaching, you know, in high school, or God help us, junior high school, was not my calling. And so I decided I wanted to go into publishing. And I just looked up. We didn't even really have the internet back then. That's how old I am. I looked up in a book called The Literary Marketplace, the LMP. I don't even know if it's still published. It's probably online somewhere now. I looked up all the publishing houses in Boston, and I sent my resume to all of them trying to get full-time employment, and one of them got back to me saying that they had an unpaid internship, and would I be interested in interviewing for that, to which I said, oh my gosh, yes, that would be fantastic. And that was my first job in publishing, an unpaid internship at David R. Godin Publisher, which is still alive and kicking, and which I'm now actually this season going to be doing freelance publicity for one of their books. So that's kind of come full circle too, which is really neat. I worked there for the 3 or 4 months that you were supposed to work there for the internship. And then I didn't have anything else to do, and I really, really liked the books and I really liked the people. So I just kind of kept coming in 3 times a week. And finally, David Godin looked at me and said, I guess we should probably just start paying you, right? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. And, you know, that was the start of my publishing career. I worked at Godin for, gosh, I guess 4 or 5 years. And then I worked at Houghton Mifflin for a little bit. And I thought that Houghton Mifflin would be where I would grow old and die. It's an amazing publishing house here in Boston. But I was only there for about a year, and then what was basically a startup, the Perseus Books Group, came calling and asked me if I wanted to apply and interview for a publicity director position that they had there, which was a significant jump for me in terms of title and salary too, but it was especially that title that sounded really nice to me, director of whatever. I was still in my 20s. So I interviewed for it, and they offered it, and I passed on it at first because I wasn't sure that the kinds of books that they were doing were a great fit for me, but their publisher took me to lunch and told me the vision that they had for expanding the list, which is what you call the, you know, the books that they're publishing, expanding it and growing it and branching out, and I liked the plan that he had in mind, and he seemed great, and so I decided to just make the jump to leave Houghton Mifflin after a year. And then I was with Perseus for like 20 years, which was awesome. We were able to grow it. We started imprints, which are sort of like little, gosh, I don't even know how to describe them, little series of books that you do. And that was exciting to be on the ground of. I learned so much. And I didn't go into publishing thinking that I was going to be a publicist for books, if you want to know the truth. I thought I'd be an editor. I think everybody who goes into publishing thinks that they're going to be an editor. One of my jobs here at Emerson College, where I teach, is to show my students that if they want to be an editor, great, these are the things they need to know, these are the skills they need to develop, and if they don't want to be an editor and want to explore other areas of book publishing, there are some awesome departments, there are some awesome things that they could do with their life, be it publicity or marketing or sub-rights or sales or production or design. There are so many different things. And so part of my job is to show them what else in the world of book publishing exists. So I've been doing that, teaching here at Emerson for about 16 years now.
Well, as a publicist, when you get involved with a book, at what point are you involved? I mean, do you, and especially now that you're on your own, do you talk to authors before they have a book deal, or it's always after the book is published, or what?
It's pretty much always after the book is about to be published. In other words, when it has been acquired by the publishing house. Another word that we use for acquired sometimes is signed by the publishing house. So once they have a contract with a book publisher, it would be appropriate for me to start talking with them then. But the fact of the matter is, if it's nonfiction, before they even get to me, they need to write the darn thing, because again, most nonfiction is written on is signed on proposal. So they might only have a sample chapter and an outline done at the time they get their contract, and then they write the book, and then once they turn the book into their editor, they can start to focus on promoting their book, and that's when I come in. And usually that is about 6 months before the book actually hits bookstores. That's when I would start trying to get people in the media excited about that book and trying to get them to commit to covering the book in some fashion. That's my job. That's what a book publicist does.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And my guest this week is Lissa Warren. She's written a couple of books, including The Good Luck Cat and The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity. Lissa Warren, I'm curious to know if you know how many books that are sold nowadays are sold as books and how many are sold as ebooks.
That's a great question. I don't have those numbers at my fingertips. I bet some of my colleagues here at Emerson do. It's a great question. I feel like most books these days are done as hardcover and ebook simultaneously. In other words, they're available as printed dead tree books in bookstores and as ebooks, you know, on Kindle or Amazon, whatever, at the same time. And the reason for that is when books are marketed and publicized, you figure that will increase the sales of the book, and you want to be able to capitalize on the sales of the book in multiple formats. So you want to have the ebook available and the printed book available. Also, there's a third format, and that is audiobook. And I know that audiobooks are growing. In fact, they're growing to such an extent that many publishers will not offer an author a book deal unless part of that deal is that they get the audiobook format in addition to the printed book format and in addition to the ebook format. Publishers want all three so that those marketing and publicity efforts can be, you know, capitalized on in all formats, which is smart publishing, frankly, and makes sense, and smart for authors too, because, you know, you want to have as many readers as you possibly can. That's your goal as an author, right? Should be, anyway. Should be to make money, because if that's your goal, yikes. Authors don't make a ton in most cases. But if your goal is to have a lot of readers and get your book read by people, you want to meet the reader where they're at. Some readers are, quote, reading books as audiobooks or reading ebooks or reading printed books. And if it is going to be a printed book, then the editor and the publisher and the author and perhaps their literary agent, if there is one, if they're involved in the conversation, they're going to be hashing out whether the book will be published right off the bat as a hardcover or right off the bat as a paperback, in which case you call it a paperback original. And if it is published originally as a paperback, there will probably never be a hardcover edition of the book unless that book becomes a New York Times bestseller and kind of a modern-day classic, and you decide to do a hardcover gift edition of it, you know, on the 10-year anniversary of the book's original publication or something like that. Those are rare. So usually if you publish as a paperback right off the bat, that's the version that's out there for the rest of all time, I suppose.
Kurt Vonnegut's Sirens of Titan was originally a little paperback book.
I didn't even know that. Was it really?
Yeah.
Gosh, that deserves a hardcover.
Yeah, they eventually
I'm sure they
got
did.
That, yeah.
Vonnegut.
Yeah, it's interesting because books, audiobooks, or when they usually be just like a few like books on tape incorporated in places like that. And people kind of look down on you if you just listened and you didn't read, that was cheating us in some way.
I think there is a little bit of a stigma, but the people who listen to them swear by them. I am not an auditory learner. I'm a visual learner. So audiobooks are not the answer for me. But I know people who love them. The really annoying thing, though, is that they're all physically fit people. They are people who, I'm telling you, they are people who put on the audiobook, cook their healthy dinner, and then
run on their,
go
on
for
their,
a run.
Yeah,
yeah they
Walk
do. It drives me bonkers.
Rather, we're listening.
Well, that's not me on any of those fronts, but, God bless the people who like their audiobooks. That's fine. A book is a book, even if it's an audiobook, is how I look at it.
I absolutely agree. But the thing for me, you know, I have to read a lot because I have this radio show where I talk to authors. And the readers, and some of the readers are fantastic actors and very good. And sometimes they have the most famous people in the world have read them, Tom Hanks or Laurence Olivier or whatever. But they're always acting, and they read very slowly because they're acting. And I don't have time for that.
No, I don't either. And I don't think in this day and age many people do. And I think that's one of the reasons that audiobooks are selling like they are, because we're all so busy that we need to be able to multitask, and audiobooks do allow that. We also are all, you know, jetting all over the place and driving all over the place, and, you know, it's an easy format, and I think ebooks, because they're so very portable in our fast-paced society, that's one reason that they're doing so well and selling so well. So, yeah, times they are changing, but, you know, I don't think the printed book is going to die anytime soon. If it were going to die, it would have died a few years ago when ebooks really came into prominence, and they didn't. They're alive and kicking, so I don't foresee the death of the printed book.
That's so good to know, because I like books.
Too. I like the way they sound when you kind of crack them open. I like the way they smell. I like that tactile sense of turning a page. I like being able to dog ear a page. I occasionally must confess that I take a pen to the book if there's a passage that I really like, or God help me, even a highlighter, you know, or I'll scribble something in the margins that I want to remember. I like being able to interact physically with a book in that way. So I care about the environment, but when it comes to books, I'm all for killing trees. That's the bottom line.
Yes, you called it, what'd you call it, a dead tree book?
A dead tree book, yeah. That's what we call it sometimes when we go out for drinks after work. Yeah.
So let me ask you, of the authors that you've worked with, and you've worked with some famous ones, who's the biggest pain in the ass? No, I mean, tell me some of the authors you've worked with and what it's like to work with them.
Well, I've worked with Alan Arkin, the Academy Award-winning actor. I've worked with Jenny McCarthy, the former Playboy playmate. I've worked with Duff McKagan of Guns N' Roses and Tony Iommi of the heavy metal band Black Sabbath. I've worked with Jimmy O. Yang, who is this amazing comedian and actor. He is on HBO's Silicon Valley, and he was in Crazy Rich Asians, and the man can write. I've worked also with some amazing octogenarian historians. Maybe you wouldn't think that those would be the ones that I'd mention, but people like Harlow Giles Unger, Thomas Fleming. I worked with Harlow on 8 or 9 of his books. I mean, basically the whole latter portion of his career, we were side by side with me doing the publicity for them. It was such an honor. It was so much fun. He got to become a friend, not just an author, not just a client, you know what I mean? When I got laid off, he was one of the first people to call me. When I fell and broke my kneecap in half, he called me every day for weeks just to cheer me up and make sure that I was doing okay, because he had broken his hip and he knew what it was like to have to go through a tough recovery. I've been so fortunate. I've worked with such talented authors, but even more importantly, I've worked with such nice people. Not all of them, to your original question, but more good than bad, by far, by far.
Well, you mentioned Professor Unger, who's been on the show here, thanks to you, with me several times.
Yeah.
And what a terrific guy, you know, so brilliant.
Oh, he's such a smart man, and he's like pushing 90 now, if he hasn't already hit it, and sharp as a tack, and still writing books, most importantly. And I can't say that I was somebody who read a lot of history growing up or in college even, but thanks to him, I love a good, like, presidential biography, because when you read his books, it's not like you're in a class being lectured to. You know the way that history books can feel that way sometimes? Instead, it reads more like a novel. There's this strong narrative and these very real leaping off the page characters, and they were real people, but he makes them seem real, and that's the art of a real historian as far as I'm concerned. So
also, they're only 250 pages rather than some of those 900.
Yes, he does not write tomes in that way. You can lift them, you can prop them open on your lap and not have your leg fall asleep. Yes, they are brief as histories go, but yet not, they don't feel incomplete. You know what I mean?
I do. I love them. I'm a big fan.
Good.
Now, Jenny McCarthy, did she actually write her book?
She wrote most of it. I mean, I think her editor had, you know, a decently strong arm there at the end, because Jenny was, like, busy and committed to film projects and stuff like that. But
I'm shocked that she's ever read a book, yeah.
The whole concept was hers. It's called Belly Laughs, and it's about being pregnant, and was a book that was very lighthearted and became one of those great books that has two buyers. One buyer was the woman herself who was, you know, going through pregnancy and just wanted a little company along the way, somebody who, like, could understand what she was going through and a few laughs to keep things light. But then the second buyer for the book was the friend of the pregnant woman, or even the husband of the pregnant woman, somebody who was looking for a gift for that person. And so it sold incredibly well. It hit the New York Times bestseller list. It stuck on the New York Times bestseller list for several weeks, like more than a dozen weeks. A lot of books that have the name, you know, or the words New York Times bestseller on the cover of the paperback, they were legitimately New York Times bestsellers, but it doesn't mean that they were on it for more than 1 week. They might have hit the lowest spot on the New York Times bestseller list for 1 week and then fallen off completely, never to be on that list again. But any smart publisher would still call it a New York Times bestseller, and they'd put it on the cover of the paperback, and they'd publicize and market it that way in perpetuity. And her book actually hit and stuck. And I have to tell you, too, you know, when you asked me earlier about books that I really loved working on and was proud of and things like that, you know, even some of the books out there that maybe were not as literary, maybe were not as carefully crafted, they have sold very well, kept the lights on at publishing houses, kept people's jobs, and have made it possible for those publishing houses, because they had steady teddies in terms of sales, made it possible for those publishing houses to be a little more adventurous, to acquire a book that they weren't certain would sell well, but that they really just loved and felt deserved to be out there in the world. And if you don't have any books that sell well, you can't afford, literally, to do that. So, you know, I publicized a lot of vegan cookbooks. I'm not vegan. I don't know how to cook. Some of them were really good books, but even the ones that weren't, that sold really, really well and made it possible for, you know, memoirs to be published by people, memoirs by people who weren't well-known but just had something important to say or had just done something in their lives that was special, they could afford to take a chance on those books because they had some vegan cookbooks that sold like the bejesus. And so that's what you hope to have. Every publishing house needs some books that are just incredible books that they can be proud of because of the quality of the writing and the ideas inside those books, but then also some books that just sell so that you can take a chance on some books that are not givens.
Now, you like baseball.
I do like baseball. Well, my dad, you know, indoctrinated me early. He was a Yankees fan, which was tricky during the years that we lived in Cleveland and is incredibly tricky now that I live in Boston. But I am at heart, because I am my father's daughter, still a Yankees fan. Don't tell anybody. I'm glad that your show is in California. Hopefully none of my Boston friends will hear.
People will beat you up, right?
They would. But I'm little and, you know, I have MS, so what kind of person would that be? But
a Boston
anyway.
Red Sox fan. But so you've done some baseball books.
Yeah, I got to do most recently a book by Louis Tiant, the pitcher who deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Yes, definitely does, but isn't yet, but definitely does. He was lovely to work with, I have to tell you. He is Cuban by birth, and he has a very strong accent, so I didn't always understand what he was saying, but I could always tell that it was something kind or something funny. I got to drive him around to a bunch of bookstores here in Boston, and he was a delight to be with. He really, really was. And that's one of the great things about this career. You get to meet people that you would never think you would get to meet. And the cool thing about Louis is that he had played in all of the places that I have lived. He'd played in New York, he'd played in Cleveland, and he'd played in Boston. So we had lots to talk about. That was really fun. I also did a book on Fenway Park. That was really, really neat. And then I did the publicity for a book called High Heat by this really great writer, Tim Wendell. And it was all about, like, the fastest pitchers and the quest to find the fastest pitcher and sign them to your team before anybody else does. And the unreal numbers, speed-wise, that are being put up these days by these new young pitchers. Not the kind of book I would have ever picked up on my own, but I really enjoyed it. It was really well done, and he was delightful to work with, too. So, yeah, I like to work on baseball books. I get a kick out of it. And I like to go to games every once in a while. That was one of the great perks about working at Houghton Mifflin. They had a box, and every once in a while, when an employee did something really good, they got tickets, and you could sit in the box. And, you know, when you sit in a box, they feed you. Like, you don't have to get up to get the food. The food comes to you. It's really nice, plus a good view.
Yeah, at a baseball game.
Yeah.
The food is most important, but the fact that they're playing baseball is also
yeah. Sort of... Nachos, you know?
And I think I got a thriller from you the other day in the mail.
You probably did. I bet you got Emma Copley Eisenberg's The Third Rainbow Girl. Is that the one that you're thinking of?
Yeah.
That's a big one for Hachette Books this coming season. It's her first book. She is an incredibly gifted writer. Amazon chose it as one of their books of the month. Apple chose it as one of their books of the month. And we just found out that it's going to be an Indie Next pick. The Indie Next organization, IndieBound, is a group of independent bookstores that have sort of band together to try to select and then promote really, really worthy titles, like the cream of the crop, and her book got selected for that, which is super, super cool. And she did that sort of immersion journalism thing that some people do. It's a book about two murders that took place in Appalachia, and she actually moved to Appalachia for a period of time so that when she was writing about the way that those murders had impacted the community, she knew that community that she was writing about. In other words, she did it the right way. So it doesn't read like reportage. It reads like she was there because she was. It's a really good book. I hope you have her on your show.
All right, I will. You know, if any of our listeners are authors and have books and want to know how to get them attention for those books, there's a book I can recommend to them, and it's called The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity, a comprehensive resource from building the buzz to pitching the press, and it's written by Lissa Warren. And for anybody on earth, I want to recommend this other book called The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. And the brilliant author of those books is my guest, Lissa Warren. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure, my friend. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.